Broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, I'm Mark Dunlay.
And I'm Tyler Novak. We start off with part two of Mark's report on the protest this week in Albany over the Williams Pipeline, with Governor Cuomo has until Thursday to decide on.
Then, for our weekly Peace Bucket, we hear from Ursula Rosam about her work with Code Pink and the occupation of the Venezuelan embassy in D.C., as well as the status of the effort to enact single-payer health care in New York State.
Afterwards, we'll have a weekly food diary with Amy Halloran interviewing Steve Riddler of Troy's Farmers Market.
In a late-breaking story, we're going to hear from David Arthur, who is running for the Landsberg School Board. Election is next Tuesday. And that's going to follow by a recording of comments from the New York State Writers Institute director Paul Rondell and Pulitzer Prize-winning author and Albany native William Kennedy, who spoke at the recent Albany History Fair. But first, let's start to show off with some headlines.
Advocates rallied at the state capitol on Tuesday in support of the Medical Aid in Dying Act, also known as physician-assisted suicide. While the measure has picked up the support of Governor Cuomo, as well as many legislators and an increasing number of medical providers, passage is still expected to take a few more years. New Jersey recently became the eighth state to pass the act after 7 years of debate. According to the Times Union, the bill would allow terminally ill adults with a prognosis of 6 months or less to live the ability to be administered life-ending medicine from their physician.
The Associated Press reports that Governor Cuomo has signed legislation allowing judges to reduce prison sentences for victims of domestic abuse who committed crimes while defending themselves against their abusers. The bill allows judges to change the sentence from incarceration to community-based programs considered more effective in rehabilitating survivors.
The Times Union reports that opposition is rising among homeowners in Albany's Buckingham Lake neighborhood over a 5G or fifth-generation cell phone network that is being installed in 22 cities across the U.S. Organizers of Stop Albany 5G are calling for a citywide moratorium on any 5G cell tower installations until possible health impacts have been studied. Such studies are supported by David Carpenter, an environmental health sciences professor at the University at Albany. A 1996 federal law blocks local governments from stopping cell towers because of possible health effects. The New York Times recently published a story suggesting that the effort to oppose these 5G systems are part of a Russian conspiracy to undermine America's competitive edge.
Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul was at School 2 in Troy Tuesday to announce that the state was given $600,000 to Troy nonprofits for anti-poverty programs in the North Central and Hillside North neighborhoods. Recipients include TRIP, the Troy Rehabilitation Improvement Program, Unity House, the Community Architectural Program TAP, the Boys and Girls Club, and the Arts Center of the Capital Region. Capital Car Share will also receive $12,000 to start a car sharing service in North Central Troy. Over a quarter of Trojans live in poverty. Census data also shows almost three-quarters of Troy's black youth live in poverty.
A new report shows that plastic will release 850 million metric tons of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere in 2019 alone, equal to the emissions from 189 new 500-megawatt coal power plants. Based on industry projections, by 2050, plastic projection and incineration could consume 13% of the entire carbon budget left for planet Earth to avoid global temperature rise above 1.5 degrees Celsius.
That's it for news headlines. On May 2nd, groups came to the National Grid meeting in Albany to call for the state to halt fossil fuels, especially the Williams Pipeline, and support renewable energy, particularly renewable heat. We hear from Lee Zeech of St. Energy, Assemblymember Robert Carroll, Aaron Mayer of Clearwater and Sierra Club, Lisa Marshall of Mothers Out Front, Kim Fratchick of SANE, Laura Schindel of Food and Water Watch, and Jessica Asley of Agree. In the second part of a two-part segment on the Williams Pipeline protests in Albany on May 13th, we hear from six speakers. Lee Zeesh is the moderator.
But luckily, there's been an incredible grassroots movement fighting this from day one and a lot of support from our elected officials. So we're about to hear from somebody who's been leading this charge in Albany to stop this pipeline, State Assemblyman Robert Carroll.
Thank you, Food and Water Watch. Thank all of you for coming out this afternoon to oppose the Williams Pipeline. The governor says that he has a Green New Deal. The governor says that he believes in energy efficiency, independence, renewable energy goals for the state of New York. Well, if he actually does believe in those goals, he can do something very easily in 3 days, and he can veto the Williams Pipeline. If he believes in his own Green New Deal, if he believes in his own proposals about making New York energy efficient, renewable energy independent, then he cannot agree with a fracked natural gas pipeline that's meant to last the next 50 years.
That's right.
So the choice is simple. We either believe in a future that is based on renewable energy, or we believe in a future that is apocalyptic and based on fossil fuels.
Climate impacts to these projects, and we know what kind of communities that those affect first and worst. So right now we're going to hear from somebody who's been on the forefront of the fight for an environmental justice for a long time and knows what the vision of the future can really be for our communities. National Director and former President of the Sierra Club, Aaron Mayer.
But at the UN, just down the river, they're saying that we have to act within 5 to 10 years. Right now, we're on a glide path using a corporate-driven agenda to save the planet. And they're trying for shareholder value to maximize their profits by burning as much carbon now and in between then. The reality is our species and every species on the planet is in the balance. We are at 1 minute to midnight. And sadly, this is the state that gave us the New Deal. And it's now one of the proponents through one of its freshman congressmen of the Green New Deal. So how can we have that innovative spirit here and at the same time be the source of imminent doom for our country? Our president, our dirty democracy funded by that carbon sector, comes from New York. Let's make no ifs, ands, or buts about it. Our national president, the national train to disaster, comes from New York. So we owe the world and the country to clean up our economy, clean up our energy sources now. The challenges facing New York are not upstate versus downstate. It's whether or not we're going to become a fracking infrastructure pipeline state.
That's right. I'm going to introduce Lisa Marshall, who's an organizer with Mothers Out Front. She's got a little Mother's Day message for Governor Cuomo.
This is an amazing event. I'm so excited to be here. The reason I'm here is I live at the intersection of two of the biggest frack gas pipelines in New York State. I live in Horseheads, New York. It's one of the poorest counties in the state. Our county accepts frack waste into our landfill. There are communities in my town that can't drink their water because of gas drilling. We do have gas drilling still happening in New York. Because of National Grid's claim of need for gas for more upstate customers, which they never verified, a brand new compressor station was built in a poor rural community in my town. This is not acceptable in my town or any town in New York. We have the solutions, we can do better. I call on National Grid not to settle for 80 by 50. We need total decarbonization and we need a commitment from every utility that operates in New York State. Governor Cuomo, you have heard all of us so many times. You know the science, you know the policy, you know what we're asking. We're going to be delivering to you today a letter signed by over 150 organizations in New York calling on you to stop the pipeline build out and build the renewable energy, renewable building infrastructure in New York that we so desperately need to lead on climate. We know you can do this. You have the power.
We banned fracking in New York. Frack gas infrastructure is expanding everywhere. And behind that, in a lot of those places, are utilities. So to talk about the big picture and what's going on across New York State, we have Kim Prochek from Sane Energy Project.
This is happening to communities across New York State. This is going to happen to communities across the United States. And we know that there are not just the Williams fracked gas pipeline coming from Pennsylvania, where my mom lives right now, into New York Harbor, but we also have the Stop Cricket Valley fracked gas power plant group in Dutchess County working to halt an 1,100 megawatt fracked gas power plant. We know that we have a group called Protect Orange County in Orange County trying to stop the CPV fracked gas power plant. We know that we have a community called People for a Healthy Environment in the Finger Lakes region working to stop frack waste, bomb trains, bomb trucks. We know that we have the Northern Access Pipeline out in Western New York that Governor Cuomo denied the water quality permit for at the 11th hour, and the federal courts overturned it, and now the pipeline is coming back. People are sick of fighting the fossil fuel industry. They're a manipulative industry. They work in collusion with the public utilities to keep a monopoly over our lives. When people ask us, why don't you just get solar? Why don't you just drive an electric car? It's because those choices are not available to us because they set our law to work against us. This is a big global picture. And a little bit more about this horrible frack gas monster of the Williams pipeline that is right now threatening some of the communities that were hit hardest by Hurricane Sandy. And to talk about the Williams pipeline, we have Laura Schindel of Food and Water Watch.
Laura Schindel, I'm an organizer with Food and Water Watch. Folks have mentioned the Williams pipeline. I'm just going to give a brief overview of why we're so opposed to that pipeline. It would carry fracked gas from Pennsylvania through New Jersey and then along the shores of New York City. It would go along the shores of the communities that were hit hardest and are still recovering from Superstorm Sandy. Staten Island, Coney Island, and the Rockaways. Construction of the pipeline would require dredging of the sea floor. There are toxins that lay dormant in the seabed from the industrial era that would get dug up. Lead, arsenic, PCBs would all get churned up during construction, impacting recovering marine life, turtles, endangered species, and impacting beachgoers who bring their kids to enjoy New York City's iconic beaches at Coney Island and the Rockaways. Williams Company, which is an Oklahoma-based energy company, is notorious for having their infrastructure leak and explode, resulting in fatalities and injuries. We do not trust Williams Company to build.
Jessica Asley of Agree.
To speak on behalf of Renewable Heat Now, we are a coalition of 11 organizations working together to make sure that New York gets off of fossil fuels for heating and onto heat pumps.
Yeah.
Recognize the enormity of this challenge. Over 90% of households in New York use fossil fuels for heating right now. Thirds of those households use gas for their heating source. The rest use other types of fossil fuel. Somehow, some way, we have to transition all of these households off of fossil fuel heating and onto heat pumps. We are committed to this. A year and a half ago, about 100 of us came to Albany and we stood on the $1 million staircase to deliver our Renewable Heat Now platform to Governor Cuomo. The platform is simple. We need more resources for geothermal and air source heat pumps, and we need them now because these are the technologies that we have today that can help people transition off of fossil fuels. We need resources for low-income households. We need utilities to stop expanding their gas infrastructure for heating. Transition people directly to renewable heating. And we need building codes that ban fossil fuel heating in new construction.
This has been part two of a two-part series by the Hudson
Mohawk Radio Network on the pending decision by Governor Cuomo as to whether or not to approve the Williams gas pipeline. And as I just said, that was part two of our coverage of the Williams pipeline. The decision is due actually sometime late Wednesday night or Thursday morning. Up next, Ursula Rossum is a staff person for Code Pink and Physicians for a National Health Program. She discusses Code Pink's efforts to protect the Venezuelan embassy in D.C. and the upcoming May 28th public hearing in Albany on single-payer health care with me on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network. So we're talking with Ursula Rossum, who is now one of the organizers with Code Pink. And I've seen a lot of photos of Ursula recently hanging out at the Venezuelan embassy in D.C. What's going on down there, Ursula?
At the Venezuelan embassy in Washington, D.C., there is a group of activists that are living inside the embassy. They've been there for about a month now. And they call themselves the Embassy Protection Collective, and they are there to protect the embassy from being taken over by the opposition diplomats appointed by Juan Guaido. Juan Guaido claims to be the president of Venezuela, and he has been recognized by Trump as such. And he wasn't elected, but he was appointed there. And so the embassy still belongs to the government of Nicolas Maduro, who is still recognized by the United Nations as the president of Venezuela. So there are peace activists protecting the building. They have the keys from the Maduro government. There's members of the Green Party there, activists with Code Pink and Popular Resistance, and Vets for Peace protecting the embassy from being taken over by the pro-Guaido government.
Now, how has the local police been in terms of providing protection to the people inside the embassy? Because I have seen there seems to be quite a bit of people on the outside and even having problems getting food into the embassy to help feed the people inside?
On about April 30th or May 1st, diaspora Venezuelans living in the United States began gathering in front of the embassy. These are supporters of Juan Guaido, who opposed the Maduro government, and they set up an encampment and blockaded all the doors to prevent food and medicine from getting in. And the D.C. police and the Secret Service have had a very heavy presence there now for a couple of weeks. And they've been rather aggressive with the peace activists. Whenever the activists try to deliver food and medicine to those protecting the embassy from the inside, there are clashes, pushing by the pro-Guaido folks that don't want to let the activists deliver the food. And the police have only been detaining and arresting the peace activists. And on Wednesday evening of this past week, PEPCO, which is the Washington, D.C. power utility, under orders from the Guaido ambassador to the U.S., turned off the power to the embassy. So now the embassy protectors don't have any electricity, and there's no way to get food in. We've been able to get medicine in via the Secret Service and some friendly police officers. But they're cut off from food. They've had their electricity turned off now.
Now, I know last week we had another one of the orchestrated coup attempts by the United States, and the opposition held a press conference out in front of, one of the military bases, indicating the military base had swung in their favor, which turned out not to be the case. It just doesn't seem like the Venezuelan people are rallying to Trump's call to overthrow their duly elected president.
Before the attempted coup, most Venezuelans didn't know who Juan Guaido was. You and I received just as many votes for president of Venezuela as this person, Juan Guaido. And we have to realize that even despite any mistakes by the Maduro government, there are many people there that still support him because he's inherited the legacy of Chavez, who, by nationalizing the country's oil reserves, was able to invest heavily in healthcare and education and housing. It's from what I understand, it's a very polarized, politically polarized society right now. And those in front, you know, that are blockading the food are loyal to Guaido, while the embassy protectors have been receiving many messages from people in Venezuela via Twitter videos and Twitter messages, thanking them for their actions. So it's a very polarized situation. And I'll just add that Trump has vocalized concern about a humanitarian crisis in Venezuela. But one thing that the mainstream media fails to cover is that in August of 2017, Trump imposed sanctions on Venezuela, which prevent the flow of food, medicine, and medical devices into the country. And according to a recent report by the Center for Economic Policy Research, this has resulted in the death of at least 40,000 people. When we talk about the sanctions, what we're talking about is medications to, like antiretroviral medications for people with HIV, for people that need dialysis, or people that need cancer treatments, aren't getting what they need because of U.S. sanctions against Venezuela. So these sanctions aggravate an already difficult economic situation. And we see that this is a tactic that the U.S. uses repeatedly to try to destabilize governments that oppose U.S. economic hegemony. In the 90s, U.S. sanctions against Iraq were responsible for the death of over 500,000 children. So what we're seeing now in Venezuela is, you know, part of the pattern of U.S. foreign policy in the world.
Now, like many young people, unfortunately, it seems like you have to pass together a couple of different jobs in order to support yourself. And so I understand your other job has been working with the Physicians for National Health Program for a couple of years, trying to enact a single-payer health care system. Many of us hope that with the Senate going Democrat this year, we were finally there. Hasn't quite occurred yet. I know the hearing is coming up on May 28th. What's the prospects, and why do we want single-payer in New York? Isn't it going to raise our taxes?
So many people struggle to get health care, not just due to lack of insurance, but because their current insurance is unaffordable due to high copays, high deductibles. People are skipping things like medication, regular checkups. And on May 28th, we're going to have a really historic opportunity in New York to turn out in Albany and to speak about all the different reasons why we need a universal health program here in New York. This is going to be an opportunity for people to share about their personal experiences, struggling to get what they need within the system. And we are planning on publishing a report based on a survey we did around the state. 2,500 people around New York shared their stories with the Campaign for New York Health of barriers accessing care. We've heard so many stories of people losing their houses, going into severe medical debt that destroys their credit scores. Just so many heartbreaking situations of people not getting the care they need. And so on the 28th is really going to be an opportunity for New York lawmakers to hear from the people of New York why we so desperately need universal health care.
Do we have any prospect of passing it this session, or is this something coming down a few years down the line?
We are going to pass universal health care in New York and in this country. It's just a matter of when. And so you never know what's going to happen in Albany. And the hearing coming up is really our opportunity to keep making the case to the public and to lawmakers about why passing the New York Health Act is essential. So right now, at this moment, we have 30 co-sponsors in the state Senate for the bill. 32 is a majority. So at the moment, we're really working hard to get some of those Democrats who ran on their support of the New York Health Act to actually follow through on their commitment and sponsor the bill. So
can you give me the 30 seconds, which is all we got? Why is single payer good for New York?
Single-payer healthcare will guarantee healthcare coverage to everyone, regardless of your income, your age, your immigration status. It'll save us money and give us the peace of mind we all deserve.
So we've been talking with Ursula Rossum, who is Code Pink and Physicians for National Health Program. This has been Mark Dunley for Hudson Mohawk Radio Network. Quickly, your two biggest websites.
So for Code Pink, if you want to learn about what we're doing related to Venezuela, codepink.org/Venezuela. And to learn about the New York Health Campaign, visit nyhcampaign.org.
That was our weekly piece segment with Ursula Rossum of Code Pink and Physicians for a National Health Program.
For those just tuning in, and even if you've been listening for a while, I'm Mark Dunlight.
And I'm Tyler Novak. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, WOOC 105.3 FM Troy, and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org or get in touch with us through email at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
Up next, we have Amy Hollerin talking with Steve Riddler of Troy's Farmers Market.
Hi, I'm Amy Hollerin, here with another Food Diary, and Steve Riddler from the Troy Waterfront Farmers Market. Welcome, Steve.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm good. I'm excited to talk about the farmers market. Since a billion years ago, I was looking forward to opening day and the outdoors. So tell me what you're thinking about as the market is now in its outdoor position, fully geared up to serve Troy.
Well, just to say that when you were excited thinking about the first market, I was a customer at the first market, literally. So I was also thinking about it, pretty excited and geared up for that one, with my little bags ready to go, see who was there.
That's such an amazing circuit that has happened, right?
So yeah, no, I've been a customer there for many, many years, and then I joined the market as their vendor committee, looking at new vendors about 2 or 3 years ago, and was helping them with their development plans. And then Liz Hammond, who was the previous manager, you know pretty well, I'm sure.
Yeah.
She left to do her own thing. And so I said, hey, I can help out. And here I am now, looking forward to trying to figure out how to make it work on the streets of Troy.
That's awesome. So what are the good challenges? Let's describe for someone who's maybe never been down to the market what they haven't seen if they haven't set foot in Troy on a Saturday morning between 9 and 2.
Yeah, so 9 o'clock, it all starts. The vendors are all in place. There's 100 of them this year, just over 101 of them this year.
My eyes are rolling. You can't see that in Radio Land, but they're really rolling.
Yeah, and, you know, maybe we'll make her eyes roll so that you can hear them. You know, the market really starts at one end of River Street and now runs all the way down past the monument, all the way to Lower River Street and State Street, which is, I don't know, maybe 3 or 4 blocks you could actually walk it from one end to the other. When I was thinking about extending it to Lower River Street, thinking, my, that's a long way. I then went into one of these super Walmarts, not that I go there normally, but I went in there to look and see what it would be like. I thought, you know what? That's probably further than what we've got as a footprint. If you were to walk from one end to the other or back and forth and round all the aisles, then. So don't be put off by the length that it might be. Just take your time, stroll around, look at all the vendors. They've got a lot to show you. So we have the Maker's Market, too. That's on 2nd Street, and sort of a food hub around Monument Square. So we have prepared food vendors from all over the place, all set up around the square. What we've done this year is listen to the customers who were a little concerned that it was a little crowded in places. So we've tried to spread things out, move some vendors around to make some more sitting areas and sort of creating little lounges, so to speak. So as you're walking through the market, you can take a break, chat, move to one side, meet your friends, sit down. You know, this year we moved the Muggsy's Barkery, who does all the dog stuff. We moved them to another location. They were really psyched because there's quite a big space next to them with chairs, and the dog owners were all hanging out. And so, you know, dogs are permitted at the Troy Market, but we ask that they take great care That they're under control and that they, you know, take good care of the hygiene efforts that we have to put in place when there are dogs and food around. So right now we're still having dogs there.
But, awesome. That's good news for dog lovers. And, yeah.
But, you know, it's a two-edged sword, so we have to be careful there. Also, we have a new children's home. The Troy Y MCA has come down, and they're on the stairs, on the platform by the stairs down to the Riverfront Park, and they have a kids' zone there every week programmed. So stop by. They've got a lot of things going on there to introduce everybody to their own programs up the hill. They wanted to come downtown, and this is the first year we've managed to pull that off. So that's a new thing for this year as well.
That's so great. And it's the community partners that really help make this market a special place, not to diminish whatsoever the importance of the vendors bringing in their food. But I think that unique quality of inviting in other groups who are then an invitation in and of themselves and have activities that create energy, literal energy, in the instance of the Y, that we're going to be burning calories in kids and families. It's a super thing, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And then, yeah, we have two music stages now, one on the monument, another one down on Lower River Street. So we have music in two places all day long. We have community tables set up throughout. I mean, this last week we had four community tables, you know, which was a lot, but thankfully there's a few vendors. Well, not thankfully for the vendors, but for us, they weren't there because they're organic and their produce isn't quite in yet. So they weren't there, or the peach guys were waiting for their fruit to come in, you know, so there's a few people, we have spaces, but we use those spaces wisely so that they, you know, we had community tables there. A lot of them are health related and talking about that. We're trying to get a lot of partners this year with nutrition and maybe sort of walk the market with a nutritionist, walk the market with a restaurateur, walk the market with a doctor, you know, sort of have little programs that we can do. So once we get up and running and get our feet wet with the new vendor layout, we'll start to program things like that. That'll really help with the food, understanding of food. So we're trying to really explain to a customer what it is they should be looking for, what they can get and how they can eat and all the rest of it. So there's a lot of that sort of programming stuff we're going to try to bring in this year, which is pretty cool.
That's super exciting. I'm chomping at the bit to know how you can find out about that. Will they be drop-ins? Are they sign-ups?
We'll put that onto the website and on our social media as we get going. There'll be information at the market table. So we're still thinking about how to make it work, but I think it's going to be drop-in and make it work that way, sign up in advance but it's all going to be free, however it's going to work like that. So
that is so great. There's really endless conversations that can be had about what food is, where it comes from, how it's different, and how you're supporting agriculture and how you're supporting your personal body in this world. That's really exciting. So with that, how can people find out? What's the website nowadays?
So the website is troymarket.org, and that's very simple.
And troymarket.org.
Yep.
Okay.
And that's where you can go and find out most of our information and our links to Facebook and to Instagram and Twitter. Twitter is very much just the market newsletter these days, and we're still trying to, when you put an old guy in charge of a website, it's, we have to get the youngsters in, so that we have the interns and the market assistants saying, that's how we do it, And my daughter tells me she can tell when I'm the one who's been posting, because I tend to use punctuation in Instagram, and apparently that's not something you do, but hey, we're out there right now. And interestingly enough, we actually had our top Instagram post with number of hits recently was one we posted of a 1900s picture of the Liberty Street Market.
It was really cool.
Everybody liked to see that. And I tell you, there's lots of horses. No horses allowed at the market this year. But the picture was of a market that was very thriving and packed. Obviously, all local vendors coming in, which is what we have now. And it's busy. The streets are really thriving and busy. People are going into all the shops and restaurants. They hang out and beyond the market. So that's a pretty cool thing.
That's really wonderful. And what about any teasers about the ideas that are swirling about how the market might evolve?
Yep. So the market has really been looking to see how it can evolve. We had a study done by the Project for Public Spaces, which is a market consulting firm out of New York City. They have a a market, you know, a farmers market program within their suite of offerings, and they worked for us for a little bit in the fall and looked at, you know, what we should do. And we heard from a lot of people, a lot of clients, a lot of vendors, a lot of public. Keep the market as it is. Don't mess it up. Don't, you know, try and evolve, but don't mess it up. You know, whatever you do, don't mess it up. That was the bottom line. So you know, evolving without messing it up is our mantra. And that means that making sure we take, you know, not tentative steps, but deliberate steps, flexible steps, so that, you know, you take the market in a direction that's not going to threaten its viability, and also try and give customers more what they want, which is, in, you know, in Troy, is to provide food on a day-to-day basis, fresh food. You know, I mean, Capital Roots is doing it in the smaller stores, but we're looking at maybe trying to find a way to bring the vendors into downtown on a more frequent basis. And that currently our thinking is in a smaller, you know, 4,000 to 5,000 square foot arcade market hall type place where vendors could be in and out, popping up, coming and going, you know, creating like the storefront market atmosphere that you would find in Europe, or, you know, a small version of Pike's Place or something like that.
Older cities, older American cities, yep. Public markets.
Yep, public market space where vendors will be able to come in, and they'll be there throughout the day. So we're thinking it through. We're looking at opportunities, trying to figure out how to make that work. But that would be the first step. Obviously, looking to also look at, you know, is there opportunities for other markets in other parts of the city, different days. But, you know, that all boils down to capacity, and you don't want to overstep.
Oh, no.
As you know, starting a brand new market, it's very interesting.
Yeah.
As you know, you have to figure it all out. So.
Yep.
But it's definitely changed from the day that you were looking forward eagerly to your first market.
It's really crazy to see what the city and the market has become. And I'm really glad you're steering the ship. It sounds like you've got your imagination and brains and heart all in.
Yeah, absolutely.
Great. Thanks for coming in today,
Steve. Oh, you're welcome.
Steve.
Thank you so much for the chance to talk about it.
Sure. This is Amy Halloran, and you've had another Food Diary.
And you can tune in every Wednesday for the Food Diary with Amy Halloran. Up next, we talk with David Arthur, who's running for the Landsberg School Board, not the Troy School Board, as I initially thought. And so we hear from David. We're talking with David Arthur, who is a candidate for the school board in the city of Troy next Tuesday. David, can you briefly explain to people what does a member of the school board do in the city of Troy?
Okay, first of all, it's the Landsberg School District, not the City of Troy School District. So that's the north part of Troy. It's a smaller district, but not a lot. I'm running for school board. The budget vote is, and school board here, candidates election is Tuesday on the 21st. You know, the school board members, I think there are, I should know this, but 8 or 9. There are 2 spots open. 4 of us are running. Right now they put together a budget, which is a bit contentious because the tax levy caps exceed, which is usually 2% increase, and this is only a 1% increase, but because they, from my understanding, because they paid off all their debt, they have a 0.4 percent cap, so they need a 60% approval of the budget. So that is something that the school board puts together. If it doesn't pass, they will have to either put it back for a revote or come up with another budget proposal. Other things that the school board does is hiring. The superintendent is retiring in December or January, so there's going to be a hiring committee. One of the things that I would really like to do if I get on the school board is it's a very diverse student population, a lot of people of color. I would like to see more teachers and staff from a bigger pool of diversity. It's not at the moment. So And when they are looking for a superintendent, that might be something to consider. So I'd like to put that sort of in there.
Now, does the Lansingburg School Board, what geographical area does that cover? The old town or village city of Lansingburg, or are there other places in that school district?
Well, there's no, like, town of Lansingburg. It's part of Troy. It's the north part of Troy, from 101st Street up. And then it also covers Spiegeltown and a little bit of Brunswick. So there's it's a diverse district with some really rural and then some fairly urban areas. And in the past, when my son was going to elementary school, he went to Rensselaer Park. They had two elementary schools, and they had it divided up K through 5 based on geography, where you lived. So Turnpike Elementary School had mostly the more rural areas, and actually a little bit more of the wealthier student population, but and Rensselaer Park had more of the urban. But they changed that a few years ago, and now Turnpike gets the whole district, but pre-K through second grade, which my daughter is now finishing up, and then everybody moves over to Rensselaer Park for third through
fifth. Okay, we only have about 4 minutes left. So what are some of your visions for what you want to do as a school board member besides a diversity issue?
Okay, great. Yes. Well, I mentioned diversity, right? Another thing that's been really big for me is that the elementary school students only get 10 minutes of recess time. Total, they get half an hour to eat lunch, get to the lunchroom, eat lunch, go out and play. So basically 15 to 20 minutes to eat and 10 minutes to play, I just think is not enough. I've talked with a lot of the teachers and administrators and parents, and nobody is happy with it. And I think that it would be easy enough to add some more time, to give them more playtime. They found in every way that helps academically and physically. So that's one of my things that I really want to do. Another thing is that, and the school board is, even when they were interviewing me, brought it up, that there's not a lot of the community involvement in school board decisions. Nobody comes to the workshops or the meetings. So I would like to find ways to make the communication better. So a lot of the events in the schools are well attended by parents, the plays and the open house and even dances, things like that. So I think there's a way to get the school board information at those things to increase communication and dialogue. So those are some of the things.
So, and what you mentioned previously, you have a daughter in the school system now, you used to have a son in the system. What are some other qualifications you bring to the position?
Okay, I do a lot of volunteering directly in the school. I'm a writer and a photographer, so I've gone in and worked with kids in that way. I also coach for over 10 years art, for the Olympics of the visual arts. I'm really active for over 15 years with the PTAs, so I'm a regular active volunteer that way. Also do a lot of volunteering in the community and neighborhood organizations. So I have that to bring, skill sets, but I also, worked in a non-for-profit, writing grants, dealing with little money to make it stretch a long way. So I know that that's an issue as well. So have that to bring.
What time is the election on Tuesday?
It's from noon till 9 at night at the polling stations.
At the polling stations. And do you have a Facebook page or anything, web page for your campaign?
I'm on Facebook, my own personal Facebook, Dava Arthur. I don't have a web page, but I
Okay, well, this has been Dava Arthur, and she'll be, what's your ballot line on Tuesday?
I'm third.
Third.
So,
okay.
Yep, I'm on the third line.
Dava Arthur, Lansingburg School Board election, and this has been Mark Dunley for Hudson Mohawk Radio Network. And that was Dava, and she did want to remind viewers that besides voting on the candidates, people should go out and vote on the school budget on Tuesday.
Next up, we have Willie Terry. He recently attended the 20th annual Albany History Fair on May 5th at Cherry Hill Mansion in Albany. In this segment, he records comments by the director of the New York State Writers Institute, Paul Grandel, and Pulitzer Prize-winning author and Albany native William Kennedy.
It's my privilege to introduce today's honoree, William Kennedy, who was the first person I met on the campus at the University of Albany on Labor Day weekend in 1981. Yay. He was working on a holiday weekend, which tells you what you need to know about how to become a great writer. I'll not recite the lengthy list of literary awards that Bill has received because we'd be here for a very long time. With Suzanne Lance, I co-edited and wrote the introduction to a retrospective book published last fall titled Bootlegger of the Soul, The Literary Legacy of William Kennedy. He was born in 1928 and grew up in a working-class Irish enclave of the North End in a modest apartment that contained very few books. He became an award-winning reporter at the Albany Times Union without the benefit of a journalism degree. He was a journalist who wrote novels on the side. Kennedy eventually transitioned to full-time fiction writer and part-time adjunct instructor at UAlbany. He and his wife Dana, who's here, taught dance, ran a consignment shop, and they endured many years of financial strain. Personally, I'm extremely grateful that Bill took a portion of his MacArthur Genius Grant and created the New York State Writers Institute at UAlbany in 1983. I'm honored to serve as the third director in its 36-year history. We've brought 2,000 of the world's greatest writers to Albany, earning us the reputation as one of the preeminent literary presenting organizations in America. Bill is also the greatest chronicler of Albany, in fact and fiction, in this old Dutch city's four centuries of history. Bill's art is that he uses his creative imagination to reconstitute into fiction the actual events he lived and experienced over his long life, what he learned from the countless assignments he covered for the Times Union, and the incalculable knowledge he gained from his tireless combing of the city's old newspapers, historical archives, and overlooked nooks and crannies of documented information. But don't simply take my word for it. Here's what Saul Bellow had to say. Quote, "There are no dead sentences in Kennedy's work. His language is vigorous, full of energy. He's just a pure writer." So please join me in welcoming this year's honoree in Albany's own, the original bootlegger, Bill Kennedy.
Thank you, Paul, for that introduction. Finally, I started writing something about my family, and it seemed different, and it was about Albany. I had Morris Gerber's book, Old Albany, which was the first issue. It was all there was in those days. There was one edition of that. There's about five or six, I think, ultimately. And it was wonderful. It was a magical mystery tour for me, and going back in time with each individual photograph to see what the city looked like in 1850 or 1898 or 1932, and then trying to place it like with the buildings. This trolley car, I think that must be in a parade of some sort. It's like a float rather than an actual trolley, and it's like a memory of the trolley days, but there was no such bus line or trolley line called North Albany. But anyway, I knew there was something missing in my brain and it was the history of Albany. I was trying to place all these characters in the novel in, from the, something like 1890 through 1950, and each one would move the family forward, and I was, when I came to the Times Union, I used to work in here in the 50s, and then I came back in 63, and Gene Robb, one of the first assignments I got was to write a history of the neighborhoods of Albany. And Walter started going out and interviewing everybody I could who was over 90. Because I was well aware of the obituary pages and old folks dying with all that knowledge vanishing. And so I circled the city and went to every neighborhood and every ethnic group that I thought was, you know, eminent in the history of the city. And I put together, 26 article series. And I just discovered this town, and in the course of, I spent hours in the library, and it was such a revelation, the history of this city. It's so well documented, and such enormous variety of kinds of history that we have here, to it's endless. And the political papers of all the governors and the mayors and everything, and the political machine, and Paul chronicles Erastus as one of the characters in the machine, and I wrote about him as well in O Albany, and again in a novel. But it was endless as subject matter. I never had to go out in the world like Hemingway always wanted to go to war, Graham Greene was traveling the world to find a new subject to write about. But I was learning from Faulkner, who never left home, Mississippi, and became a chronicler of the whole South through a single individual town. And that's the way I felt I would work. And that's what I have been doing. And today I began to focus on, what am I going to say down there today? And everything was focused on what I heard today from various people who were talking. It was about the idea of a story. And that's what happened to me. I began to see Albany as a story. And that's the way I began to tell it. Back in 1964, the second year I was here after my return, I found a note about a year ago that I wrote back in 64, and I had seen it through the years, but I'd really forgotten exactly what I wanted to go back in time and start with the Patroon, start with Killian Van Rensselaer, start with the Mohican Indians, and come forward into the Dutch, into the English, and then forward into all the ethnic arrivals, the Irish and the Germans and the Poles, and then into the contemporary the Spaniards in the early part of the century, the Italians who came in such vast numbers that we had a consulate on Madison Avenue. And then the Burmese and the but I wasn't when I wrote 64, we were still talking about of black migration from the South into Albany and Chicago and the northern cities. But that was one of the new changes of the motion of people. But it was always a story, and I wanted to put it all in one book, and it was ridiculous and absurd. But that's what I thought I would do. And what I started to do was I wrote one book about, I started writing about the political machine, which was so dominant, so powerful for me, and my family was all involved in it. And I started to tell a story of that, and then I discovered the story of Jack Diamond, the gangster. who was at one point working with the political machine and was killed by the political machine. And it was a, it just took me over, the book, and I spent 6 years writing it. And God knows what I'd have spent writing the other 350 years that took me to 6 years to write about a guy who only lived to be 32. Anyway, the idea of the story never materialized. I went back in time. I found Billy Phelan's Greatest Game when I was doing some research on legs. And Billy Phelan led me into Ironweed, and then Ironweed led me into Very Old Bones, and so on. And I went back in time to the beginning of the middle of the 19th century to write Quinn's book, and I was doing a parallel story of two centuries following the same character who was living both in the 19th and the 20th century. And it was a good idea, but it ultimately got done by the French lieutenant's woman. I thought it was too much of a gimmick, and I gave up on it and just focused on the story of the 19th century. But ultimately now, when you look at my books, I mean, it is beginning to be a chronology if you take them apart piece by piece and put them in chronological order. There's some continuity about it. It's trying to tell what I set out to tell back in 1964. And it wasn't crazy. I mean, the idea is still viable, and I'm actually still working on it, and something like that. And I'm actually going back to the Mohicans. And anyway, so I can go on and on and on and on, and I just think I should shut up. Thank you for this honor and being part of it.
We're so glad he came back from Albany and didn't stay down in Puerto Rico. William Kennedy.
And that was the Hudson Mohawk Magazine Roman Labor Coordinator, Willie Terry, reporting with author William Kennedy and Paul Grondell from the recent Albany History Fair at the historic Cherry Hill Mansion in Albany on Sunday, May 5th. But that concludes our show. We hope you've had a wonderful time and enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Mark Dunlap.
And I'm Tyler Novak. Our engineer tonight is Felix McGuy. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary.
As a reminder, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. You could be one, too. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort or at the sanctuary in general, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or just stop by one of our exciting weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7:07, held right here at the beautiful Sanctuary for Independent Media in North Central Troy. Thanks for tuning in.